This podcast features graphic details of real events taken from letters written by inmates convicted of murder. Listener discretion is advised.
When I was sentenced to death, I was at peace, but sad, because I would never be free again.
These are the written words of Texas McConnell Unit inmate number 319790, John Quinones. They're taken from letters that he wrote to us in 2019.
I believe in the death penalty, especially if you were sentenced to it. Some people deserve to die.
My name is Ned Parker, and Quinones is one of over 2,000 inmates that my colleague Zoe Hines and I have corresponded with in our work as documentary producers.
This is Letters from a Killer, a Podimo podcast. Episode 14, Ice Cream Killer.
Why do we produce documentaries about murderers? Why do we make this podcast? It is probably for the same reasons that you've chosen to listen to it. To somehow try to understand what it is that compels someone to commit the most serious of crimes and to take the life of another human being, to become a murderer. Of course, every case is different. Every murder is preceded by a unique set of circumstances that led to that moment when the individual made their fateful and fatal decision to kill. People are driven to kill by desperation, by passion, by greed, or simply through malice, stupidity, intoxication, mental instability, or a tragic lack of forethought. But putting simple judgment aside, no matter how misguided, tragic, or outright odious a murderer's reasons might have been, I do believe that in most cases, it's possible for us to come to understand, at least in part, what it was that motivated that person to act as they did. But this episode's letter writer falls into what is a relatively small, but ultimately far more unsettling category of killers. Someone whose motivations are seemingly a complete anathema. This has to be one of the most bizarre crimes that we've covered yet. It starts with the hijacking of an ice cream truck, but ends in sexual assault and murder.
This episode's letter writer claims that he never planned to kill his victim, and that the strange events that led to murder that day just spiralled out of his control.
Before we hear from the letters of Quinones, let's familiarise ourselves with his case file.
Letters from a Killer. Case file. The following information is taken from the court case of John Quinones, as well as police documents. June 1978. John Quinones hijacked a neighbourhood ice cream truck, driven by local vendor Muhammad Ali Vedat. He then picked up two colleagues and forced Vedat to take them to a Houston drive-in movie theater. During the journey, Quinones pocketed money in the ice cream truck's cash register, took Vedat's wallet, watch, and a tape recorder, and struck the victim with his gun. Quinones allegedly then told a colleague to take over driving, while he forced Vedat into the back of the ice cream truck and carried out a sustained physical assault. When the group reached the theater, Quinones allegedly told everyone that, as he was currently on parole, he would have no choice but to murder Vedat. Witnesses at the time allegedly stated that they heard Vedat begging for his life. Quinones's colleagues fled the scene while he drove Vedat away in the ice cream truck. The following day, the body of Muhammad Ali Vedat was found in a wooded area outside of the Houston city limits. The cause of death was a gunshot to the head.
This crime escalated from a joyride to a murder over the course of just a few hours. And you're not really able to track the logic behind the crime from what we've heard so far. But it does seem that there was deadly intent on Quinones' part from pretty early on in the process.
Before we hear Quinones' own recollection of the murder itself, though, we're going to start by hearing about his early life. The following extract is read by an actor, but these are our letter writer's unedited words.
I was raised by my grandparents, on my father's side. They loved me so very much, to the point of me being spoiled. It was the best time of my life. I always wanted to be a clown, so I can make everyone smile and be happy. As I got older, I wanted to become a school teacher, so I could teach and care for other kids, like my teachers did me. There were always bad influences, from parents who you trusted, older neighborhood boys, my cousins, even a man who was supposed to be my big brother, only to find out all they wanted to do was use you. Drugs? Yes, I did them. From sniffing glue, smoking weed, taking acid, my favorite, and pills of all kinds. Only to later go into shooting up heroin, coke, and meth. I also drank a lot. It became a problem, especially because I started so young. The neighborhood bully gangs forced you to join them, so they can use you or abuse you.
The fact Quinones begins by describing his upbringing as spoiled here is certainly unusual. It's not the background inmates typically describe when they write to us, but it's less the domestic circumstances of his background that stands out in this passage, and more the inclusion of some pretty uncomfortable references. You may have already clocked some classic horror tropes in this story. We've had an ice cream truck, and now our murderer writes about how he wanted to be a clown when he was a child. This is familiar imagery in terms of popular culture, and while Quinones might have been in prison for the last four decades and separated from society, I can't imagine that he's unaware of the sinister connotations those images have. Perhaps he's trying to grab our attention.
I think that's certainly a possibility, but I also think Quinones is definitely pitching himself here as someone who wants to make others smile. He is referencing other people a lot and his relationship to them. He's obviously very conscious of people and how he presents himself from, I'd say, a very early age.
We do ask a lot of the inmates that we write to about their history with substance abuse, as it's often intrinsically linked to their crime.
Sniffing glue, smoking weed, taking acid, my favourite, and pills of all kinds.
With Quinones, that does appear to be the case. But it's interesting to look at how he describes his relationship with drugs here.
He pitches this as a kind of spiralling point in his life. But it's the way he writes it. He just says,
drugs? Yes, I did them.
And then goes in a single sentence to list those drugs that he's taken.
Only to later go into shooting up heroin, coke, and meth.
He has essentially listed everything it is possible to consume, and he's done so in one very simple sentence. And for me, this kind of gives an indication that he could be somebody who feels that they went downhill very rapidly and that the drugs were really at the heart of that descent. Let's hear what happened on the day of the murder itself, as written to us by John Quinones.
It was like any other day. Get some cash and drugs, get high, and hang out with my friends. But I needed a ride to the drive-in movie where my friends hung out. I had money and drugs from robbing the night before, but didn't even think of taking a cab there. I was pretty high on drugs and drinking. Then, I heard this ice cream truck coming down the street. My mind flashed, there is my ride. I ran down the street a couple of blocks and waited for it. He stopped for me to buy some ice cream. I told him I wanted to borrow his truck and him for a bit of a ride to the drive-in. And that was it.
The very first words of this extract are, it was like any other day, getting cash, drugs, getting high, hanging out with his friends. He's normalising the entirety of this experience up to the point of the murder itself. I mean, imagine starting an account of the day where you took an individual's life, which resulted in your imprisonment for life, with it was like any other day.
And then, when you take that in context next to the enormous list of substances he's previously mentioned, it's clear that this is somebody who was massively dependent on narcotics. We're beginning to get a sense of the man as someone who was out of control, impulsive, and that this is somebody who is in no way connected to reality at this point in their lives.
I guess he thought I was playing, because I looked young and friendly. He soon changed his tune when I pulled out the revolver and pistol-whipped him with it. It didn't seem like it was me, so violent and mean. It was like I was watching someone else. It must have been the drugs and lack of sleep. I had not planned to kill him. I just needed a ride. I picked up a couple of friends, and off we went to the drive-in. I was feeling good and started giving ice cream to everyone I saw. I know it was stupid, but the whole thing was, even how it ended. The poor Iranian was dead. He died alone, in a strange country, and in a very ugly way. An accident. He was at the wrong place at the wrong time. I can't say I had any feelings at the time.
In this section, Quiñones doesn't even attempt to explain why what seems like a slightly madcap idea of stealing an ice cream truck suddenly becomes horrifically violent. Instead, he distances himself from it, saying, "That moment didn't seem like it was him, so violent and mean." It underscores how disconnected he is at this point from the reality of what's going on.
But stealing that ice cream truck is a conscious choice. And it fits back in with that sense of him performing for others. He wants his friends to see him arrive in it. He's showboating for these friends. What we can only assume is that he's looking for a reaction. He either thought it was funny, or perhaps he thought that it would maybe give him some sort of kudos and respect.
Another extremely strange phrase that I want to draw our attention to in this extract is "the poor Iranian was dead."
He died alone, in a strange country, and in a very ugly way.
Having gone through the trial and having been confronted with this man's death in a formal scenario for a considerable number of years, it's very hard to believe that Quiñones wouldn't have known his victim's name. Presuming that he does know Vadat's name, he has instead chosen to refer to him as simply the poor Iranian, and that reduces him to an object with no relation to him.
And it's the fact that in the same sentence, there's a moment where it feels perhaps that he is actually attempting to show remorse or concern for his victim when he writes,
"He died alone, in a strange country, and in a very ugly way."
But then he ends this statement by trying to claim that the murder was an accident. He knows the truth. He knows that this person died in a horrific way, that he was sexually assaulted and shot dead and dumped in the woods. But he's attempting to spin an alternative version. And it almost feels as if he's forgotten his own lie.
Either that, or we're reading two entirely different voices here. In combination with Quiñones' earlier proclamation that the violence didn't feel like him, you almost get this dissociative sense from all of this. Is this a case of split personalities?
We've heard the details of the crime and how Quiñones apparently didn't plan to kill his victim. But the case of our letter writer doesn't end with that day's strange spiral of events. There's more to the story. So let's hear how the official version was established and how it played out in court.
Letters from a Killer. The Verdict. The following details are taken from official news reports and court documents. In September 1978, the trial of John Quiñones began. He was eventually found guilty of capital murder and sentenced to death. In May 1981, his sentence was commuted to life. Quiñones has been behind bars for over 30 years.
The details in the case file at the top of this episode were very much established in the trial of Quiñones. One of the ways that the information was verified was through a wiretap recording that one of his friends was willing to make. And it was during that wiretap that Quiñones was heard confessing to his crimes.
This wire recording was played at his trial and resulted, in part, in his conviction for the murder and his death sentence. But Canales' lawyers weren't made aware of his existence until only 5 days prior to the trial. And this was the grounds that Canales used later on to appeal his death sentence, and which enabled him to have his sentence commuted to life with a minimum term of 40 years.
We've certainly come across a number of people who've been sentenced to death and then later had that death sentence commuted to a life sentence. Whenever a death sentence is given, the inmate automatically qualifies for an appeal.
When an appeal is successful, as it was in the case of Canales, and the inmate is taken off death row, they normally express a sense of relief. But when we wrote to ask Canales about his sentencing, he wrote back with a very strange sense of self-reflection, even stating in his letter that he should have died on death row.
I really had no feelings in the aftermath and the time of my arrest. I was drug stupid. I knew I was in big trouble when the man died. In my first few days in prison, it was so unreal. I was lonely, scared, and lost. When I was sentenced to death, I was at peace, but sad, because I would never be free again. I am sorry and regret every action that day. I hurt so many people. I still feel like I should have died on death row. It does not matter how long I've been locked. I could never pay for what I did. I was a very bad person and deserve all this time I've done, and more. I am sorry for his death and his family's loss.
So did Quiñones discover a sense of remorse in prison? These words of regret do feel different to those minimising his victim.
It sounds like somebody who is directly identifying with the loss that they've caused through their own actions and who is taking responsibility for that. But then we discovered another incident that complicates this conclusion.
10 years after his conviction for the original ice cream truck murder, Quiñones was convicted for another violent event that occurred inside the prison walls.
We asked him to write about that in his letters to us.
In 1988, I was in love with a young man, only to have to hurt him because he lied to me. He said he was involved with gang members. We were still friends and always will be. I got 5 years for it. He committed a worse thing. Death. He took his own life.
7 years after Quiñones' sentence was commuted to life, he established a relationship with a fellow prisoner and then attacked him. From the extract here, we assume Quiñones' lover committed suicide. Quiñones conveys that as a crime in itself.
He committed a worse thing.
As if it were some kind of unforgivable act.
But public records show that what Quiñones refers to as having to hurt his lover, quote, was actually attempted murder. Quiñones was charged with attempted murder with a deadly weapon for this attack, and he got an extra 5 years on his sentence for it.
When we requested an interview with Quiñones, we were denied on the basis that he'd been transferred to a psychiatric unit. Now, we're not psychologists or medical experts, but from my experience reading about inmates deemed psychotic, this very literal, "he hurt me so I hurt him" line does perhaps fit with the dissociation we discussed earlier, the inference of split personalities. They're all traits associated with psychopathy.
Interesting, though, it's our understanding now that Quiñones is once again housed back in general population in his prison. In the final extract we're going to hear from Quiñones, we asked about his time on death row. And in his letter, he expanded on his previous statement, where he said that he had felt that he should have been sentenced to death.
I took death row one day at a time. And to be honest, I really enjoyed it. I had no worries. How do I feel now I'm out of it? I hate it. I should have got killed on death row. I got 40 years on his life. I guess I am paying for this crime and the ones I never got caught at. I believe in the death penalty, especially if you were sentenced to it. Some people... deserve to die.
It does feel to me that there is some contrition here, that Canonis recognizes that he is a bad person and that he believes he deserves punishment. It also feels that perhaps he's acknowledging that, as the worst of the options he feels he could have faced, his life sentence is somehow subsequently apt.
But aside from the fact that Quiñones is still alive, the key difference between these sentences is that he is now eligible for parole. And because the original crime was committed back in 1978, that eligibility starts about now. Quiñones could one day walk free, believing he's paid for both of these violent crimes and for those extra incidents he nonchalantly refers to here, those crimes he says he never got caught for.
In this episode of Letters from a Killer, we've heard from the letters of John Quiñones.
I heard this ice cream truck coming down the street. My mind flashed. There is my ride.
We're presented with a man who knows he did wrong.
I am sorry and regret every action that day. I hurt so many people.
But who distances himself from the violent reality of his actions.
It didn't seem like it was me, so violent and mean.
A man who seems extremely conscious of how people see him.
I always wanted to be a clown, so I can make everyone smile and be happy.
Yet struggles to recognize himself.
It was like I was watching someone else.
Next time on Letters from a Killer.
Once Amin was on the cold ground on his back, he started to talk to me, pointing up at the sky. I placed the gun on his forehead and told him, "Who has the power now, Amin? Fuck you," and blew his brains out.
Letters from a Killer was hosted by Zoe Hines and Ned Parker and is a Podimo podcast by Transistor Films. Support the show by sharing on social media and following the podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.